Acelin Antrim with Pharmacy Times. Welcome to Pharmacy Focus, Psychedelic Pharmacy, where we take a look at one of the fastest growing markets in healthcare, psychedelic medicine.
Can you introduce yourself for me?
Yes, my name is Rick Strassman. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine.
So historically, psychedelics have not been really widely accepted by the traditional medical community, but that seems like it's starting to shift a little bit, at least in terms of the research. What are your impressions of this and where it currently stands?
Well, they were a real growth area in psychiatry in the 1950s and the 1960s, kind of like they are now. Without the commercial involvement, which is a marked difference between the current wave of interest and back then. Back then they were being used for end of life despair treatment, for substance abuse, particularly alcoholism and heroin abuse, a little bit for pain, some for depression. But then after they more or less escaped from the laboratory, they became Schedule I drugs, and clinical research ended, although preclinical research didn't. The advances in serotonin pharmacology, antidepressants, SSRIs, the second generation antipsychotics, those all grew out of basic science research that used the classical psychedelics, like LSD in particular. There's been a renewal of interest. The first new clinical study with these compounds took place in Germany studying mescaline, and our studies in Albuquerque focused on DMT as well as psilocybin. There were a few studies after mine that I helped with, them getting off the ground. There was an OCD study at the University of Arizona, MDMA studies at Wayne State in Detroit and UCLA, and an Ibogaine study in Miami. But things really got rolling with the mystical experience psilocybin study at Johns Hopkins that came out in 2006. Our studies took place between 1990 and 1995. So the interest was kind of percolating slowly, and then really picked up after that mystical experience paper. Since then, there's been depression, OCD, substance abuse, alcohol, tobacco, end of life despair. All kinds of clinical research is taking place, and there's survey studies which are demonstrating promising avenues of future research. I think it's good. I think the more tools we have in our tool chest to help psychiatric disorders, the better. There's a mass commercialization and patent trolling and new compounds being raced to be developed, all those things, so it's a bit more of a frenetic pace than was the case in the 1950s and the 1960s because of the money involved this time around. And I don't think we really want to be putting the curse we don't want to be putting the cart before the horse regarding indications and accessibility and increased availability.
Absolutely. Do you see this energy around specific psychedelics? I know ketamine, psilocybin, and DMT are several that I've heard about a lot. So are there more, some that are, being researched more than others?
Ketamine isn't what is called a classic or classical psychedelic, although at smaller doses than those used for general anesthesia, can produce psychedelic effects. And those, lower doses are quite helpful in treating people who have not responded to traditional antidepressants, for depression, TRD, treatment-resistant depression. And Spravato is a patented version of ketamine. It's S-ketamine, the S-isomer. And it's a prescription, and it's quite helpful. The only thing seems to be the frequency of use. It isn't just a one treatment and you're done. You get a treatment once every 1 or 2 weeks for a month. I can't remember the exact figures, but you come in maybe a month or every couple of weeks. Or as long as necessary, which can be ongoing, ketamine treatments. It's a lot, cheaper to use generic ketamine, and there's quite a few ketamine clinics that are springing up around the country, staffed by various levels of expertise. There's mail order generic ketamine. In some special formulations, like lozenges, or tablets, sublingual, so that's a little more of the Wild West, because you get it, mail order, and you take it at home, and maybe you have a therapist, maybe you don't, so the quality control is a little more problematic than the clinics. And even the clinics, they may not be equally careful with administering ketamine. And I'm beginning to hear accounts of people just coming in for their ketamine every week or every 2 weeks, and it's kind of like indefinite treatment. Ketamine is habit forming. It's addictive. People like, or a certain segment of people liked taking ketamine, so I think it's a interesting kind of first step towards integrating the psychedelic drug experience into psychiatry. The question about what kind of therapy do you administer in combination with ketamine? Is any therapy necessary? Those kinds of questions have really not been worked out yet. So psilocybin, within the research community is getting the most interest. But there are an increasing number of studies using LSD, for the same kinds of indications. There's a couple of DMT studies either underway or completed, for depression, for anxiety, for end-of-life despair. Those are the main compounds. Also there's some ayahuasca studies out there. Ayahuasca is a combination of DMT and a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, which allows the DMT to be orally active. You otherwise need to smoke or inject DMT. And if you can take it orally, the onset's slower, the duration is 4 to 6 hours, as opposed to just a half hour or so. There's more gastrointestinal side effects with ayahuasca as compared to pure DMT or the other classic compounds, but it also seems to be helpful in early studies anyway for depression and anxiety.
Very interesting. The last several decades kind of saw a lot of public fear around adverse effects with psychedelics, but what potential adverse effects do the data actually show?
Well, there's quite a few adverse effects of psychedelics. They're really powerful, psychoactive compounds, especially when they're given in a full dose. There was quite a bit of publicity back in the 60s, early 70s about adverse effects of LSD in particular. Suicides, murders, violence, a lot of you know, panic attacks, you know, psychosis, you know, triggering, you know, mania or schizophrenia, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder as well. And I mean, either the form of, you know, flashbacks or other perceptual or emotional recurrences of the original, you know, drug state. You know, there were, you know, quite a few, you know, case reports. There were quite a few, you know, series of, you know, cases. You know, those were emanating out of, you know, the field, you know, so to speak, like emergency rooms and, you know, psychiatric inpatient units, police departments. You know, there was only, you know, just a small number of studies that were looking at adverse reactions within the research or, you know, the clinical, you know, treatment setting. And, you know, those, you know, painted a fairly reassuring picture if you screened potential, you know, subjects very carefully, you supervised their sessions, and you provided adequate follow-up. You know, the percentage of, you know, let's say, you know, psychosis lasting over, you know, 24 hours or, you know, something like that, you know, were quite low. You know, people are starting to disclose a little more about those reports back then, though, saying, you know, that, you know, the investigators and, you know, the therapists, you know, that were using psychedelics, you know, mostly LSD, in those kinds of, you know, settings were underreporting the frequency of adverse effects. You know, so in our study of, you know, DMT, we studied over 50 people, and we screened people super carefully, you know, physical exam, cardiac exam, EKGs, lab tests, you know, research, you know, diagnostic criteria, psychiatric interview. You know, we screened at anybody, you know, with any, you know, severe mental problems, any severe substance abuse. You know, they were all normal volunteers as well. They weren't, you know, suffering any condition. It wasn't a treatment study. And even then, you know, two of our you know, volunteers, you know, suffered a recurrence of major depression, you know, which had occurred, you know, decades in the past. And, you know, thankfully, they, you know, they both responded, you know, quickly, you know, one to some supportive therapy and one to antidepressant reinitiation. You know, one person developed panic attacks, you know, but, you know, was able, you know, to overcome them and, you know, continued in the study, and he did fine. Yeah, so in, you know, 55 carefully screened, supervised, and, you know, followed up on, you know, normal volunteers, you know, there were, you know, four, you know, people that, you know, had, you know, acute, you know, severe reactions, you know, that were, you know, that were negative. You know, one guy on our, or one woman in the psilocybin study, a medium dose, freaked out, became acutely psychotic and paranoid, and, you know, ran out of the hospital. You know, thankfully, you got home okay, you know, had no further problems. You know, I've heard stories of, you know, people having, you know, problems in, you know, the research environment, and you know, those events are either covered up or they're minimized or they're not reported or they're called something else. You know, so I don't think we, you know, really are appreciating the potential, you know, for adverse reactions. And that's going to be especially the case with increased accessibility. You know, like, you know, for example, the Oregon, you know, project is, you know, going, you know, to legalize, you know, psilocybin, you know, settings or environments or, you know, sites. And, you know, the criteria, you know, for who's, you know, giving psilocybin, you know, they're not especially reassuring. For example, you need to have at least a high school diploma. Well, I mean, I'll tell you, if I were going to be given a full, you know, psychedelic dose of psilocybin, I would want, you know, somebody to be like a, you know, master's level, at the very least, if not a PhD in psychology or a psychiatrist. Yeah, you know, there's, you know, sexual abuse, which occurs even within the research environment, you know, like emotional abuse, you know, financial abuse. You know, the shamanic setting is, you know, rife with all kinds of strange, you know, interactions between the shamans and the clients. You know, so I think it's quite a bit, you know, too early to be, you know, talking about, you know, like, you know, for example, you know, descheduling the psychedelics to schedule four, you know, which is, you know, being, you know, debated out there, you know, which would, you know, place, you know, psilocybin in the same, you know, category as, you know, the benzodiazepines. Well, the acute effects of 0.5 milligrams of Ativan and a full dose of psilocybin could not be further apart. You know, so I think it's, you know, not, you know, really, you know, clinically, you know, supportable to, you know, to reschedule these compounds in that lackadaisical manner.
Have you listened to the array of other podcasts from Pharmacy Focus? We have content for every specialty, including retail pharmacists, technicians, students, and more. In the latest episode of Pharmacy Focus, Dr. Christina Madison spoke with several experts to discuss speaking your voice and amplifying your message through platforms like TED and TEDx. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, kind of speaking of adverse effects like these, how are these managed in a clinic environment, in a research study, when you come across these?
Well, the first you know, thing you do is what's called you know, talking down. You remove the person you know, from excess stimulation if it's a noisy environment, or there's there's music playing, or there's you know, too many people in the room. You just, you know, turn down the amplitude as much as you can. Stop the music. You know, get everybody else out of the room if you can. And you're empathic. You try to, you know, figure out what's going on. You're supportive. You tell them that they're fine. It's just an acute, you know, negative reaction, and it'll pass. If they're struggling with specific, you know, psychological, you know, content, you can, you know, talk about it with them. If they're just, you know, tense, you can help them relax, you know, breathing and, you know, physical relaxation. You know, the next, you know, thing would be to, you know, put your hands on the person, you know, non-sexually, you know, but, you know, like a hand over the chest, or, you know, supportive, you know, gesture, you know, hold the hand, or you put a blanket on somebody. You know, after that, you would use, you know, minor tranquilizers, like, you know, benzos. And after that, you would then, you know, have to step up, you know, to the major tranquilizers. You know, there is a German study just, you know, published using LSD and anxiety, and one of the, you know, patients had to be given Zyprexa, you know, because of agitation and psychosis. You know, so it's a, you know, stepwise, it's a, you know, stepwise algorithm.
Wonderful. As researchers are kind of looking at potential treatment environments for these, and some conversations about in the home environment, how would this work with potential adverse effects? And as you kind of said, it might not.
Yeah, I don't support, you know, take home, you know, psychedelics. I just don't. You know, you know, what happens if, you know, somebody's at home, you know, by themselves, and they, I mean, they lose it. I think, you know, I think, you know, for the, you know, foreseeable future, I think these need to be administered in a supervised environment. You know, there's an emphasis on, you know, psilocybin. And I think, you know, one of the reasons is it, you know, doesn't possess, you know, the same notoriety as LSD. And there was a German study about a year ago, you know, comparing the subjective effects of, you know, psilocybin with LSD effects in the same volunteers. And, you know, the, and, you know, there was no difference in the acute subjective effects between LSD and those of psilocybin. The only duration, the only difference was duration. Psilocybin is 6 hours, LSD is closer to 10. So when you're thinking about take home psilocybin or psilocybin clinics, I think it would be useful to at least as a thought experiment, to substitute to substitute LSD for psilocybin. Would you feel comfortable dispensing LSD for home use? And I think that there'd be a much more concern if people were kind of making an identification between LSD and psilocybin, because the acute effects are the same. The risk of adverse effects, the intensity of the visions and the voices and the dissociation and all those things are comparable. So when people are thinking about increased accessibility for psilocybin, think about if you would be thinking the same way if it were LSD instead.
That is a good way to think about it. How could new formulations of psychedelics, potentially synthetic options, minimize these potential adverse effects? Do you see any potential there?
Well, with respect to the classical compounds, like LSD, psilocybin, ayahuasca, even ketamine, mescaline, those kinds of things. I don't think you could. The only way to minimize adverse effects would be, to use low doses. There's no guarantee that, somebody wouldn't, if it was a slow release, formulation or a smaller dose, people can stockpile and a number of small doses can be, can be added up to become a big dose. If it's a sustained release, you can always cut the patch and make it instant release. They're starting to develop other compounds out there, variations on the classical drugs, some of the tryptamines and some of the phenethylamines. But if they're those compounds, if they're still going to be considered classical psychedelics, the acute effects would be more or less the same. Perhaps one might be more visual, or one might be more emotional, or one might be more cognitive. But essentially, for them to be called psychedelics, they would have to produce acute subjective effects, which are comparable, to the well-known parent compounds. They're developing new compounds, which are kind of called, for lack of a better term, non-psychedelic psychedelics, which stimulate neurogenesis and neuroplasticity, at least in lower animals, without the behavioral effects in lower animals, the most common screening tool in lower animals is what's called the head twitch response. So these compounds will produce the same biological effects as the classical psychedelics without the behavioral effects, and they seem to also, in animal models, be useful for depression, anxiety, and for substance abuse. So it may turn out to be the case that you can develop non-psychedelics, which I think ultimately will turn out to be like super antidepressants. There won't be any acute subjective effect. But they still will improve your mood and improve anxiety, and in combination with psychotherapy, they'll be even more effective.
Sure, very interesting. With this last question, you've already answered quite a bit of it, but in all of these issues that we've talked about, what is the role of the pharmacist?
Well, it would be within specialized kind of settings, either inpatient settings or special clinic settings. I don't think that we're going to see Walgreens, Walmart, CVS, handing over the counter psilocybin tablets or LSD tablets. I think it'll be more of a specialized pharmacy setting, day treatment kinds of settings, specialized clinics. There's an increasing market to use psychedelics for wellness retreats, help your meditation, help your spiritual development, creativity, those kinds of concerns. So I think for quality control, for proper dosing, especially if there's going to be specialized routes of administration, like inhalation, lozenges. There's some of the tryptamine compounds are only they're only active either through injection or through the inhalation of the vaporized compound. I think in situations of exotic routes of administration, that there would be a role for the pharmacist as well. Some of these compounds are active and are either active or some of these compounds are only active if they're injected intramuscularly or intravenously. So pharmacists would be playing a role there as well.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything you want to add? Anything that, I didn't think to ask about that pharmacists should know about?
Well, I think we need to go slow. I think there's kind of a rush to get psychedelics out there into more and more people's hands, and it's understandable, both from the ethical point of view. There's a lot of suffering out there, the pandemic and war and climate change, but at the same time, we need to be prudent and not just make the same mistakes which we made back in the 60s and early 70s. And I think we ought not to be swayed by all of the money being poured into psychedelic startups at this point. We still don't really know what the best compounds are, for the best conditions, what kind of therapy is necessary, what kind of subjective experience is necessary, if any subjective experience is required at all. So there's a lot of unanswered questions before we kind of unleash this tidal wave of psychedelic experiences.
Thanks for listening to Pharmacy Focus, Psychedelic Pharmacy. Tune in next month to hear about fascinating research into the potential uses of psychedelic medicine.